Welcome to the special episode. Today, I am partnering with Dr. Laura Shaheen. She has so many amazing credentials. She is a fertility doctor. She had her fellowship at Stanford University Hospital. She is partner at Pacific Northwest Fertility Center. She's got so many amazing credentials. But most importantly, she is an amazing person. And as you will see on this podcast, and you can certainly see her on social media as well, she is compassionate and she is kind and she is so thoughtful. And she and I today are going to bust some myths for you. There's so many myths out there. There's so much going on the internet that can be confusing and frustrating. And so she and I decided that we want to help you have a better path to parenthood by busting some myths and learning the truth about these things that you need to know. So tune in. I think you're really going to like this episode. Welcome to Building Your Family. This is a podcast about donor conception, surrogacy, and all the ways the modern family is built. My name is Lisa Schumann. I'm your host. I'm an author, a researcher, and I am passionate about helping people find a better path to parenthood. And on today's podcast, I have a person who I have a huge amount of admiration for and feel so fondly for, Dr. Laura Shaheen. She is so well known in so many circles, and I met her a couple of years ago at ASRM. She's an amazing physician, an amazing role model for everyone out there. So I'm so grateful to have her today.
Oh my gosh, Lisa, that was just a beautiful introduction. I'm blushing. I appreciate that so much. I am so happy to connect with you again. And I very much appreciate what you are doing for this community and really do direct my patients, especially to your podcast. So thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Well, we're both here to try to help people, and I'm so grateful to have you here. And I think we can try to bust some fertility myths today. There's so many things that we both get asked about. Is this true or is that not true? And Dr. Shaheen and I both agree that there's so much confusing information on the internet, and it's so hard to be stuck in the middle of fertility treatment. And then on top of that, you get this confusing information and sometimes, sadly, misdirected about where to go and what to do. So we are going to bust some myths today. We're happy to answer any of your questions. If there's anything that anybody wants to hear more about, please write us and we will be glad to answer the questions. So with that, should we get started, Dr. Shaheen?
Absolutely. I'm excited.
Okay. All right. So fertility myth number one, positions matter. People wonder if you are in the right position, are you going to be more likely to get pregnant? And if you're in a situation where you're having, let's say, an IUI, should you lift your hips up? Is that going to help? People like to throw their legs in the ceiling. So are any of those things going to help you get pregnant?
Well, the short answer is no, but I do want to validate just how frustrating it can be to be trying and it not happening. And then you think to yourself, okay, what could I do differently to improve my chances? You know, we're taught in middle school that we should be worried about getting pregnant because it's so easy. And then when we're actually ready to start our family and we're planning and it's not happening, you think to yourself, maybe it could be position. Maybe I could, you know, lift my hips up or I could make a difference somehow. So I never want to, you know, make people feel silly for asking questions like this. Like, this is a real question. But the answer is no. You know, the sperm is in the fallopian tubes and it's on its way through the reproductive tract within seconds after intercourse and is okay to relax a little bit. It's okay to lift your hips up. But honestly, like some of the things that people do, like, you know, for a half hour or, you know, sometimes people will, you know, try to keep stuff that comes out in the vagina for a long time. And then they're only increasing the risk of a urinary tract infection. There's actually some downside. It actually can be beneficial to kind of relax a little bit, but then get up and, you know, go to the bathroom, urinate and go on about your day. You do not have to keep your, you know, hips up. I tell people after an embryo transfer, right, like that's very precious. You want to do everything that you can. honestly, the data shows that people who get up and kind of go to the bathroom right away have actually a little bit of a higher success rate in randomized controlled trials. It's not statistically significant, but rather than what I was taught in fellowship at Stanford, which was, you know, this is back in the dark ages, okay? They don't do this anymore, but we used to have patients lie flat for about half an hour, even give them bedpans because we didn't want them to get up.
I had
and, oh, I see.
I was and one I'm, of those.
Well, we were all just trying to do our best. We're trying, we're in this with you and we want just to improve the chances, but we know it really doesn't matter. And I tell my patients, I'm like, if it mattered, I would hang you upside down after an IUI. I would, you know, hang you upside down after an embryo transfer, but it really doesn't matter. So such a good question. And I'm really happy to bust that myth.
Well, thank you. And on that note, what I also hear a lot about is, what about the sex of the baby? If I have sex in a different position, am I more likely to get a girl or a boy? Is there any truth to that?
No, but it's okay to understand where this comes from. Okay, so the sex of an embryo comes from the sperm. All eggs are X chromosome. And so if the sperm is an X chromosome, that baby will be XX or a girl. And if the Y chromosome comes from the sperm, the embryo will be XY and that'll be a boy. And the X chromosome is shorter. It's actually less genetic material. Now we can joke about brains and capabilities of men versus women if you want to, but we're talking about science and the X chromosome is larger than the Y chromosome. And so the theory is that sperm with a Y chromosome has less genetic material. So therefore it should be able to swim faster. Okay. So people think, oh, if I'm in a position where ejaculation can happen really close to the cervix and get into the reproductive tract faster, then maybe it'll be a boy because the Y chromosome might be able to swim faster. So I get that theory, but it just doesn't pan out. So the answer to the myth is position does not impact the sex of the embryo.
Okay. Well, thank you for telling us. That's really good to know.
I hope it's okay that I'm going into like where these come from because
it's great.
You know, I just don't want to be like flippant about it. You know, people are like, well, you know, but my friend did it in this position and had a boy and that's what she wanted. And so it worked for that person. So it's got to be, you know, there's got to be something to it. And it's like, well, but for that person, there's five other people that did the exact same thing and, you know,
didn't work.
It wasn't the same outcome. So, you know, you just want to kind of know where it comes from and just be thoughtful about it.
Right, right. Now, this is a sad one. Miscarriage is a woman's fault. Women, as you know, often feel, even if they don't say it out loud, it's my fault. I did something, you know, I got up too fast. I'm so nervous when every time I go to the bathroom because I thought I stepped off the curb too hard, or I'm sure you've heard all of these things. I shouldn't have exercised. I shouldn't have done this. Maybe I ate some deli meat or whatever, and somehow I've caused this.
I hear it every single day. We are our own biggest targets, you know, and if we don't have an answer for something, we're going to blame ourselves. But it is not the woman's fault. Miscarriage is no one's fault. Just because we think it doesn't make it true. I say that a lot in my practice. Mm. But also, this comes from a lot of history, right? Everything that's been family building, you know, everything has got to be the woman's fault, the woman's responsibility. I mean, how many wives did King Henry, you know, kill because he couldn't have a boy, even though we know that sperm causes the sex of the embryo, right? And so if you can't get pregnant, it's got to be the woman's fault. If you can't have a boy or a girl, it's got to be the woman's fault. If you have a miscarriage, it's got to be the woman's fault. So that comes from a lot of history and misunderstanding and sort of not understanding science. And then also it's almost like a soothing technique for women, because the most common cause of miscarriage is absolutely something genetic within the embryo, a chromosome imbalance, or even if the chromosomes come out normal, there are still so many genes on every chromosome that it can still be a genetic issue, even though science can't test for it yet. I really believe it's an embryo issue in the vast majority of the time. But when you don't have an answer, if you can find something to blame in yourself, then it's something that you can change and build up the courage to try again so that you could maybe have some impact to not have this grief again. So it makes sense to say, oh, it must be the gluten that I ate. It must be the glass of wine that I had. Or, you know, sometimes the male partner is like, oh, we had sex and then the next day we had a miscarriage. It must be, you know, because we had intercourse, right? And that's not true either. But then if you have this something you can blame, you can change that intervention the next time you're pregnant and hopefully not have a miscarriage. And so it's a coping technique. But the problem with that is that you still could have another miscarriage. And then you're starting this spiral of like self-blame and shame and, oh, well, I wasn't careful enough with the gluten in my diet. You know, got to look for something else to blame and change later. So it's really, I don't want to shame anyone for feeling that way. It's really common. It's really normal. You feel broken. You're assuming that the embryo is perfect because it's a child that you imagined and it was beautiful in your future, but it is not your fault. Miscarriage is no one's fault.
And sometimes, right, nature doesn't necessarily want to keep a pregnancy where there's a chromosomal abnormality anyway, right? Where Absolutely. It's our bodies functioning sometimes correctly.
Exactly. And it's hard to hear that. And a lot of people aren't ready to receive that. But I do talk about that, that it is a way, in a way, it is your body working and realizing that this wasn't going to be a healthy pregnancy, no matter how much we desire it. And your body is helping you be able to, you know, resolve that pregnancy and try again, even though it's really hard, really, really hard. Yeah.
And while we're on that, I think one thing that people need to also think about, and I'm sure you get this a lot, is stress. People say, just like they blame themselves for the deli meat or whatever, they blame themselves for feeling too stressed, right? And what is the medical proof there?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. This is really tough because it's kind of the chicken or the egg. I had a great discussion with Dr. Ali Domar from Boston IVF and Harvard Medical School, who's done so much research into mind-body connection and stress and fertility, written lots of books. I had her on my podcast in season one. It's such a good episode. And she talks about the chicken or the egg, you know, just going through infertility treatments or struggling to have your family can be very stressful in and of itself. And so what came first? Was it the stress and the fertility issues? Was it the fertility issues and the stress? And it's hard to nail it down because everybody perceives stress so differently. There are people that can have children in the middle of war and famine. And there's other people that can be, you know, truly having high cortisol levels and very high stress levels. And it could be impacting their hormonal axis, and it can throw off ovulation and throw off some of the supporting hormones that support a pregnancy. But you can't ever prove and say, oh, stress caused that miscarriage or stress is causing your fertility. I think that we can all work on stress management tools. I talk to my patients about working on whatever it is, bringing joy into your life, mindfulness, you know, therapy, coloring books, reading, time out, vacations, whatever it takes to find joy and manage stress. Because if I have two patients that are at a bus stop and they both go out into the street and almost get hit by a bus, the person who has worked on breathing and recovery techniques and calming mechanisms or has a fidget in their pocket is going to recover from that intense cortisol push faster than the person that's never worked on technique. So we all can work on techniques. Ali and I are actually working really closely. It's pretty new. We're still working on the studies on a device. It's called Otto device, O-T-O, where we're actually getting some feedback on neuroparameters and fertility patients and giving them advice on ways to decrease the autonomic response to a lot of the stressful events, seeing that recovery. And we're hoping that that feedback will help people learn how to manage their stress, not just be told, oh, just relax, right? Or just go on vacation and it'll happen. Not just telling everybody to go to therapy. Like sometimes that's, you know, access to care is an issue and all that kind of stuff. But giving some feedback and recognizing that it is really important is key.
And also, right, people don't realize that people also get raped and get pregnant and are under tremendously stressful experiences and get pregnant. Yeah. So it's so important for people not to give up hope and just kind of think it's all, as you said, some other way for us to feel some control over a situation where we feel so out of control.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. And then we stress about stressing.
Yes, right.
It's a circle.
There's more stress,
you know?
Right.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So hard. It's so hard. Well, thank you for that. That's really helpful. I hope everybody takes that to heart. The next question has to do with something that's so important, I think, for a lot of people, but particularly people who are using ovum donation. And they very often understand the ways in which the placenta contributes to the pregnancy, but they don't very often understand the role of epigenetics. So I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because I think it does make people feel a little bit better knowing that they're not just the oven.
Yeah, absolutely. When I'm talking to my patients about thinking about third-party reproduction, you know, whether it's like, I think one of the most common things that we think of is a woman who might be using donor egg. And that woman, like you said, they feel just like an oven or just sort of gestating. And sometimes even people have talked to me about like, I feel uncomfortable because someone else's egg was fertilized with my partner's sperm and I'm sort of carrying it. Like all of those emotions are real and normal. And it's good to be able to talk about those things. But I talk to my recipients, like the intended parents, like, oh my goodness, no, you carrying that pregnancy, you have so much influence over what genes get turned on and turned off. And epigenetics is sort of everything that surrounds the genetic code. You know, all these genes are on these, you know, big stacks of Legos and carried on our chromosome, but it's a very small percentage of the actual genetic content that gets expressed. You know, you can have genes for brown eyes, but still have blue eyes. You can have genes that are for short stature and tall stature, and you can be kind of right in the middle or at the extremes. And it's the things that are surrounding the DNA, the epigenetics, surrounding genetics that can really turn on and off certain genes. And so for years, you know, recipient moms have been at the playground and people say, oh my gosh, that she, you know, your child, you know, has your eyes or has your mannerisms or has your this or your that. And they kind of have felt like, oh gosh, you know, that's not my egg. It's not my genetics, but absolutely, there's a lot there. And I just think we're still learning a lot. I mean, think about how much genetics is shared. You can do cell-free fetal DNA testing from maternal blood. So in the first trimester, you can get a vial of mom's blood and find fetal DNA in order to screen for chromosomal
issues. It's amazing.
Well, so there's so much interaction and crossover. And I really tell people, you are not just a gestational tool. It is an incredible process and it's sharing. And this, we're still really just learning the significance of epigenetics. Yeah. Do you talk to people about that when you're chatting with people that you're, you know, counseling and talking to?
Sure. I very often talk about, you know, the placenta being kind of the bricks and mortar, even though the architecture is the genes. And so you're kind of still building the flesh and blood and contributing to that. But the epigenetics, I kind of see as this menu, you know, yes, you only have the donor's father's eye color and the mother's nose shape and the grandfather's musical talent and all of those things, plus your partners or the genetic contributors. And those are the only choices you can choose from. But the person who's caring gets to pick what they want off the menu. So they get to pick, okay, yes, I'm going to, not deliberately, although some people would like to do that. They get to pick, yes, I'd like this person's musical talent or their left-handedness or their long earlobes or whatever it is. And so, yes, you only get to choose from those groups of genetics, but you do get to choose. And so the baby is uniquely yours and could not be the same if an embryo was in somebody else's body. It would be completely different. So I tell patients that you have every right when your child is mean to you as a teenager to tell them that you built them and they have to be nice to you. So
I like that menu analogy a lot, Lisa. I think that's pretty neat that, because I talk about genetics and like stacks of Legos and like not everything is expressed, but I think that's a little bit, you know, kind of nerdy scientific. I like the menu and that you're able to choose different things off the menu and you know, your body is choosing some mm-hmm. of these different things. I like that. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Yeah.
So those are my questions, my top questions for you today, Dr. Shaheen. I feel like there are probably a million questions I can ask you, but those were the five that I came with tonight that people most frequently ask me.
Those are such good questions. And I get them every day in my practice as well, or on Instagram or TikTok. And yep, it's really common. I'm glad we were able to address them.
And it's so nice that you respond to people. I was just saying to Dr. Shaheen before we came on that actually today, somebody told me how wonderful it was that she was sharing all of this information in such a warm and caring way. And it really helped this person that I was speaking to today through her darkest hours. So I really appreciate you being out there as well.
Oh man, I really appreciate it. You know, I struggled to have my family, and I think it's a pretty unique situation to be a fertility doctor with infertility. It was actually really quite frustrating.
Sure.
Like I should be able to fix this. It was really quite humbling. And so my patients that are really struggling with like, why is this not happening? And I want to have like the diet or the detox or the way to control this. I can really relate to that because we're really taught that we're in so much control of everything that happens in life, right? That's a very like kind of American value. You work hard enough, you will get into that college that you want to, or you'll get that job that you want to. You're in control of your destiny. And then, fertility comes along and it just knocks you on your feet. It's just incredibly humbling. And so I think just trying to get that message out there has just been a true joy. It's a creative outlet. It's kind of fun, but it's also just, I think, kind of something that I really wish was out there when I was going through it, honestly. And just like listening to what you're doing and helping people on your podcast and your outreach is so valuable. It's such an incredibly lonely place to be. And it's nice to hear other people that have been through it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's why I do this and wrote my book and I do what I do as well. And I feel the same. I want to really help people have a better journey than I had when I was going through fertility treatment. It's so hard and so lonely. And I think, you know, one of these things that we're talking about is that, you know, we kind of go back and forth between two extremes. A lot of people today are caught in the middle of two, I think, cultural differences where, you know, many people went to their gynecologist for a pap smear at 25, 26, 27, 30, and nobody ever said to them, you should start thinking about your fertility. In spite of the fact that this person was a captive audience every year, they never had that. And certainly in high school, in their sex class, they talked about how not to get pregnant, right? And so there was so little education, and now we're kind of flung into this opposite extreme where everyone is starting to get really scared about, am I doing things wrong? And I've got a race to make sure I can get pregnant quickly. And there's so much pressure and not enough good information. And sadly, also a lot of people out there who are uneducated or not professionals who are talking about their experience only. And, you know, one of the things that I think is so important and, you know, one of the things we can talk about is that I really feel like it's so important to make sure that you get good medical care right away. And people very often wait too long, or they say, okay, well, I'll try the kind of natural route for a while, or I'll, you know, drink snake oil or I'll stand on my head or whatever. And then before they know it, they're 40 years old and they come to your office and you're in a tough situation because they probably say to you, well, my best friend got pregnant with you, and they don't know that their best friend maybe used OM donation. So you're in a tough situation because you see these people after they've consumed all of this stuff on social media about things that just aren't true. And that's going to be very, very difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've been practicing for almost 20 years, so pre-Google. And then now, you know, a flood of information that's available on social media. And I do remember when patients started being better advocates for their care and asking more questions and saying, oh, well, I actually read this study online. I remember a generation of doctors ahead of me and still some of my contemporaries that were just really mad. Like, hey, I'm the doctor. I'm the one who went to medical school. Like, why are they questioning me? And like, just kind of taking that approach or attitude to it. And I always said, hey, like these people actually really care about their health, their captive audience, they're asking questions, they're keeping me on my toes. I'm learning too. And I was never disheartened by somebody bringing out a study. And if I hadn't read it, I'd say, hey, thanks. I'm going to read this and I'll get back to you, you know? And I think now it's almost like they're flooded with information. Unfortunately, fertility community is such a vulnerable population, you know, feeling alone, wanting an answer, feeling like there's got to be an answer. So unfortunately, a lot of people that are on social media, especially if they don't have training or depending on ethics, are really going to put a lot of content out there that's based on fear to get their attention. And they're going to point out a problem, like, oh, egg quality. And then they're going to sell a solution, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people that are out there, you got to be careful if you're, you know, if everything that ends as far as a piece of advice ends to, hey, check out this link to, you know, get this or get that. I hope people have a little bit of a red flag. And I hope we're being a little bit more diligent about who we are following and really listening and trusting.
Yeah. Or you can just drink this thing or do this exercise and you can get pregnant and I can help people in their 50s get pregnant naturally. And all this sort of thing is really, really difficult, I think.
And it sounds great, but then that leads to honestly a delay sometimes. Some people are afraid to see a doctor. You know, they're afraid that they're going to come see me and I'm going to say, you have to do IVF. I will never do that. But like, come see me so we can make sure that there's adequate sperm. Because you know what? If there's no sperm and you can have as many supplements to improve your egg quality, but you're not going to get pregnant. So like getting an evaluation, making sure you have all the parts, kind of going through options, I think is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And also, I think for patients to tell you everything is also something else that I see a lot, where you may have a couple very excited to come see you, but they leave out something important and then you can't help them. Right. I mean, if there's a lesbian couple who comes to see you and says, oh, I want to get pregnant, and this partner only wants to get pregnant, and that's the end of it, you won't know to say, oh, well, maybe we should do a workup on the other one also, just in case she wants to get pregnant, or somebody leaves out a piece of medical information that's really important. And you can only work with what you've got. And so I really encourage people to tell their doctor everything.
Yes. I mean, this is a shocking story, but I'll never forget the couple that came to see me, and the male partner just kept refusing to get a semen analysis, even though I kept asking for it over and over. He's like, oh, I've got two kids from a previous, you know, relationship. I'm fine. Let's just focus on her. And, you know, she was taking on all this shame and self-blame and trying to be as healthy as she could, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, I really don't want to do, you know, fertility treatment until I know that we've got sperm. Long story short, they were doing some well-timed intercourse, finally got a semen analysis, no sperm.
Oh,
okay. Gosh. But the kicker is he had a vasectomy and never told her.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Isn't that horrible? So like you just, I mean, that is such an extreme example. You do something for 20 years, Lisa, you're going to see it all.
Yes, you'll see it all.
But that is why he was so reluctant to.
Oh my gosh.
So you're right. You should really tell everybody everything.
Yes, yes. Your doctor needs to know all the information. They can't help you if you don't know everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly.
There are so many people out there that struggle and troll the internet trying to find the right ways to build their family. They're looking for a donor or a surrogate or a clinic, and it's so hard to find the right information, particularly when you're stressed. It's hard to think clearly about the decisions that you're going to make. How do I know that? Because I've been there myself, and I've worked at some of the best fertility clinics in the world. And through my experience and seeing thousands of patients, I've learned how to cut through the noise and give patients the answers they need to their most pressing issues. My name is Lisa Schumann. I'm a therapist, a researcher, an author, and I am passionate about helping people find a better journey to parenthood. I created the Center for Family Building to help people understand how to make decisions, not just for the short term, but for a lifetime. We have group counseling, individual counseling, couples counseling, and lots of other services that can help people find the answers that they're looking for. Just take a look at our website so you can see a few of the thousands of people we helped build a better path to parenthood. The decisions you make are too important to leave up to chance. Arm yourself with the right information. Take a look at our website and sign up for a session with one of our therapists, join one of our groups, or access one of our programs, and you will quickly see why our strategies are so effective. Now back to our episode.
Well, is it my turn?
It's your turn.
All right. I get to ask you questions
okay.
that my patients ask me and people on social media ask me too. Okay. Is this true or false? People who donate their eggs and their sperm, you know, kind of third-party assistance, they're only doing it for the money.
False. False, of course. So yeah. It's very interesting. We have more research on the psychological profile of surrogates in terms of their personality types, but donors tend to be very similar in that they're loving, caring people, altruistic people, people who really want to help other people. Now, as we move from the world that was anonymous and no longer towards more openness, we see more people willing to be open about everything that the recipients want, whether it's medical information or for emotional reasons or ongoing information about their life and future children. So as we're seeing this develop over time, what we're seeing is that there are actually people who are more interested in even being more altruistic. So, you know, even though there's still financial compensation, once you take out the anonymity out of it, you see that people really want to connect. People want to do things for people. And that makes sense, right? If you see somebody face to face or you know someone, you really want to connect with them. We're seeing more and more people saying, I just really wanted to do this because I care about another family and I want to help them. You know, I think my genes are great. I want to help somebody else. Or maybe I'm not going to have children. And so I want to help somebody else have kids. And maybe I have my family complete and I have my two kids and I don't need to have any more children. Or maybe I never want to have kids. I want to travel the world. And that's just something that I want to do. So I may as well give my eggs to somebody else. And I even just saw a woman on this podcast, which everyone can take a look at. And she was a Miss England. And she decided to be an egg donor because she knew that she was never going to have children herself because she didn't want to have her own children. But she really wanted to give someone her genetics. Her family's always felt that family was really important. Her grandmother kept on asking her, when are you going to have kids? When are you going to have kids? And so in some ways, it was healing for her because she didn't have to feel guilty about not continuing her family line. She didn't have to feel guilty about not valuing family. And yet she didn't have to parent herself. And so it was like the perfect solution for her. Aww. So it was really nice. So we see a lot of people who feel that way. And it's really wonderful. Yes, of course, you know, in the news, you see these horror stories of people who, you know, continue to give their sperm to a million people, but that is the exception, not the rule. And of course, that's, you know, the media blowing that up. For the most part, they're really caring people who want to help other people to build their families. And I think we're seeing more and more, and you probably are in your practice too, where They're more known donor relationships, mm-hmm. more co-parenting agreements, and we're really seeing the expansion kind of the modern family, where people really want to contribute to a family in different ways, not just kind of the traditional, you get married, you have kids, you're a heterosexual couple, and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
People are building families in all sorts of ways. So people really have their heart in it. And I think even though it's scary for a lot of recipients to think about having a known donor as their donor, it's really a very, very lovely experience for everyone involved. And sometimes the donors will say, I'm a little bit nervous that the recipients are going to want me more involved than I want to be. And then the recipients say, I'm a little bit nervous that the donor is going to want me to be more involved than I want to be. And neither, of course, is true. And once they connect, they see that that's not the case. I opened the first open donor program at a clinic on the East Coast a few years ago. And we found that donors really wanted to be able to give the recipients what they wanted. And we thought at first it would dissuade them from donating, but it didn't. And there's a recent study that was just done about sperm donors. There was also a concern that there's a reduction in sperm donors now because there's more openness. And we're finding that that's not the case either, that sperm donors also want to give to other people and they really care about these families. So,
yeah. I always ask when I'm doing ultrasounds or connecting with the donors that are coming through our clinic. We have a matched donor program. We have our own donor egg bank at my practice, Pacific Northwest Fertility in Seattle. Yeah, it's an incredible, beautiful program. And I always ask, like, this is such an incredible gift. Like, how did you find out about our program? Why are you doing this?
Yeah.
You know, and the vast majority of donors have a personal experience with a family member or a very close friend that has struggled to build their family.
Hmm.
And they've seen somebody struggle with infertility, whether it's an aunt or a cousin. And they say, I really want to help other people that are going through that kind of same struggle. And the donors are compensated. Like these are a lot of appointments. This is a lot of injections. It's a, time off of work. So they are financially compensated. It's not this astronomical amount that's going to make somebody just do it for the money. I mean, that was what your real question was. And I'm seeing what you're seeing, that there is more of a giving, a really beautiful motivation. And it just can't be about the money. It's too much bigger than just that.
Yes.
You were starting to lead into the second question that I have for you is anonymity. You know, can you be anonymous anymore as far as donating your eggs or donating your sperm? And
so, I think many people know now that it's not possible to be anonymous, but we are kind of stuck in a situation where there are some sperm banks that still have kind of quote unquote anonymous donors. And also when there's even semi-open or open ID, where they say you can have access at 18, the truth is anybody can find anybody anytime, right? I mean, we have 23andMe and there's lots of ways to connect. You have this facial recognition on Facebook. The donor sibling registry allows people to try to figure out who their donor is or who donor siblings are. We have, unfortunately, very, very large pods of donor siblings out there. And so it's really important to know that.
That kind of goes a little bit to how do you talk to parents that just say, I don't want to tell the children. I'd rather them think that they were created in a traditional way. I don't want to tell them that they come from a donor egg or a donor sperm.
Everyone probably saw the news last week or 2 weeks ago about those two siblings who met each other in high school. It was on CNN. So it can happen, and there's way too many siblings. And so certainly it'll be important for your child to know this as they get older, if they meet somebody that they're fond of, if that mm-hmm. person's parent was either a donor themselves, or if they use donation, right? If that person's used donation, then it's important to maybe spit in a cup and send it to 23andMe before you're heading off to your date, because this is just the reality that we're living with now. So that is absolutely a must that your children need to know that. And So that's something that's going to happen over time. But in terms of disclosure, what we know is that early and often is really the rule of thumb in disclosures. So in the 1950s, there was a lot of people adopted in the US, and there was a lot of secrecy and shame around adoption. Mm-hmm. And over the next couple of decades, we found that those adult adoptees really felt good about knowing about their origins from birth. And those who found out either accidentally or had late disclosure had the most difficulties, both emotionally inside of themselves, but also with their families. And we're seeing exactly the same thing play out in donor conception, where the research is showing us again that the adult donor-conceived community who are the most distressed are complaining, rightly so, about not being told. Now, of course, their parents didn't know, many of them, but we see that accidental or late disclosure really does cause a lot of trauma for the child. It does cause a lot of identity confusion, potentially. It doesn't mean it's 100%. There are plenty of people who do just fine, but you're much more likely to have identity confusion, stress, all sorts of problems, and also problems in your family. So we really encourage people to disclose as early as possible, because what we also learned in the adoption community is that if you practice your story ahead of time, when you're even carrying the baby in your womb, you have an opportunity to rehearse your story. And many people who have infertility problems have a lot of discomfort with the story. They have a lot of pain around their infertility. There's a lot of difficulty in making peace with the need to use a donor for many people. And so you don't want to communicate that discomfort to your child around their origins. And so the way to solve for that is to start, and I have a whole book list on my website of books that I recommend, but to start to share this information with your child from day one. Now, there's a lot of people out there who haven't done that and have had a lot of difficulties. Mm-hmm. So it is important to know that while it's never too early, it's also never too late. And people shouldn't feel shame. There's a lot of shaming going on the internet about saying that if you don't do it this way or that way, you're doing it the wrong way. And people really need to not listen to that and to know that every parent is going to do the best they can and try to love their kids and try to do the best for their kids. And if you're struggling, get some help to do it. But practice and practice your narrative and give yourself some time to get comfortable with your story. I share in one of my videos on YouTube a 4-step process to sharing with your child. So if someone wants a framework, that's kind of an easy framework to follow. They can look at that. But I think it's really important to know that you'll do the best you can and you really need to own the story and get comfortable with the story. So your child will grow up feeling that you've always wanted them and you've always been happy to build this family of your dreams, which you will have.
Yeah, it's hard. I feel like in so much of my field, technology comes along and then we have to figure out how to deal with it as a society. And so 20 years ago, even 15 years ago, the recommendation from psychologists and the community and everyone was to not share. You know, you shouldn't share that you're using donor sperm or donor egg for many reasons. Number one, the community was worried that we wouldn't get people to donate if it wasn't anonymous. And you brought up that excellent study that showed that's not true. You know, people are open to sharing and they want more communication and open identity. But then also, I mean, less than 20 years ago, if you were known to use donor sperm, you were considered to not be a legal child within that marriage, right? So laws had to catch up and society had to catch up with being able to share these things. And I think that the 23andMe really pushed the envelope. You know, we've had this incredible, you know, outpouring of people who just did it as a, you know, a fun kind of holiday gift. And then it really blew up families, right? And you're talking about how there are these kind of multiple embryos kind of out there and trying to figure out what to do with them. It's hard. We're trying to figure out what to do to help people. And I really am so glad to see more openness and more communication. I've had patients that start their baby book on their fertility journey, you know, whether it's with a gestational carrier, whether it's with donor egg, you know, the first pictures are when the carrier and the intended parents first meet.
Yes.
You know, that's the first picture in the baby book. And so from the beginning, they're already, you know, documenting and sort of, like you said, sharing, like, you know, this child was so wanted. We were so excited to have a family. And this is your story. And there's other people in this story. And you're so loved. I'm so glad that that is the way society is moving, rather than trying to hang on to this secrecy and this, you know, shame with infertility. And I think it's, we're going through some bumps, but I think we're moving in the right direction.
Well, change is difficult, right?
Yeah. I mean,
change is hard for everybody, and it's not perfect, and we're all doing the best we can. But I think in the meanwhile, as we're trying to change things and as we're trying to move forward, which we're all trying to do, it's really just important to for people to be honest with their children and share with them what is out there, so they're so they know they are informed.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. Do people worry about bonding with their children because it might not be their egg or their sperm, or they didn't carry the pregnancy? Do you ever have people express worries to you about that?
So people worry a lot about that. They worry about, is my child going to hate me when they're a teenager and say, you're not my mother? That's the one I get the most.
Mm-hmm.
I say, you know, it's every teenager's job to be mean to their parents. So we can forget about that. But I also talk about how important it is to be able to understand where your child's concerns are coming from. Sometimes it's about the donation. Sometimes it isn't. I have a story in my book about a family who had a child who was donor conceived, and this mother told her daughter her whole life about her story from day one, and the child got into first grade and started to read on her own, and the mother said, okay, you know, I'm going to just leave you alone and do the dishes or do things around the house and let you read by yourself. And the daughter said, okay, and she was reading, and one day she said, Mom, I really want to meet my donor. And the mother said, okay, I'm happy to help you. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you're thinking about her? And she said, you know, I think if I met her, she would read to me a lot more. So it was really actually not about the donor. It was about the mother and her relationship with her child, and that her daughter wanted her to read to her more. So sometimes these things come up, and we're all so worried as parents. We want to fix everything and make our children feel better. But it's so, and it's so difficult. I completely appreciate that. But the truth is that your child is really going to love you. And what I often say to people is they think, oh my gosh, I can't imagine this donor. I can't imagine embracing this person when they're not genetically connected to me. They're not part of my intimate family. I don't feel comfortable with this idea. And then I say, you know, if your child was in kindergarten and said, Mom, I found the most amazing ice cream, and I've never tried an ice cream like this before in my life. I want it so badly. Could I please have this ice cream for my birthday party? You will tear the world apart to try to find that ice cream because you love your child so much. And so when your child says, Mom, how come I have dimples and you don't? You're going to want to help your child there too, right? And so people just don't realize that when they're starting their process because they can't imagine that connection. But as far as we know, it from our very, very basic days of learning about psychology from, you know, Freud to all the developmental psychologists after that, we understand that bonding happens very young, and it happens not necessarily in utero, even though people sometimes feel bonded with their child in utero, but it happens in the process of looking at your child and they look at you, you respond to them, they respond to you, they cry. And at first you don't know if that's a cry because they need to burp or they need a diaper change or they're upset about something. But eventually you say, oh, I know that cry. That's a cry because they have to burp. And so I've got to, and you get to know your child and they get to know you. And in that process, they start to feel connected to you and you start to feel connected to them. And that's the basics of trust, which is the first developmental stage for children. And that's how we develop a sense of trust in our environment and a sense of trust in the world. And that's the basic stages for any relationship, any parent-child relationship. So it doesn't happen when the child is in utero and genetically connected to you. It happens as you bond with them over time.
I talk to my patients about, you know, love is love, no matter how a child comes into your life, whether it's biologic or adoption, foster. It's just an incredible experience. And multiple times in my career, not just once, I've had patients who have one biologically connected child and then another child adding to their family with donor egg, donor sperm, surrogacy. And I am open. I say, hey, you know, how does it feel to be parenting these, you know, two different children? And love is love. It is just an incredible bonding. It's a incredible experience. I've had two patients in grocery stores. I don't know why it happened in grocery stores. Say, come up, show me a toddler. And say, you're a baby. Dr. Shaheen, I am so glad all of those previous fertility treatments that we did together didn't work. If they had worked, I wouldn't have this baby. This is the baby that I was meant to have. And it's just like this, you just have to witness it time and time again.
Yes.
And before, you know, when you're trying to counsel someone before they actually have that child, like just validating those feelings, like, of course you're going to be worried about bonding. And, you know, because in movies, we only see this one, you know, family unit, or that's all you've seen in your own family. And I can't promise you how you're going to feel, but I can share with you what other people have shared with me. And it's just incredible, no matter how that child comes into your life.
Yes. And what I see in families where there's different genetics, a biological, maybe an adopted child or a genetic donor conceived child, I see that people tend to gravitate to people who complement them the most, not necessarily people that they are like. So if the child's a really great athlete and the dad loves sports, they may gravitate to that child regardless of whether they're genetically connected or not. Or, you know, the parent who likes to chat a lot and then the child really likes to listen. She's not quite as chatty. Mm-hmm. The mom's really going to gravitate to that child because they have this complementary personality. And so I find that that's really what connects people to kind of one child over the other, because we're all human, right? We all try to love our kids equally and do the same, but some of them we have a more complementary symmetry with than others.
Yeah.
And so that's usually what draws us, not the genetics.
Yeah, I love that. Oh, I've loved this discussion. Lisa, I've learned so much from you, and I can just tell you have so much to share with people that are on this journey. I really appreciate this.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate having you here as well. And it's so nice to have this discussion, because I really think that we can help a lot of people. And I hope everyone who's out there is willing to reach out to us, because, you know, it's so isolating to have infertility and it can feel so horrible to be in it alone. And it's important for people to know that we're out there for them and, you know, standing behind them, rooting for them.
Absolutely. Well, and I would love to make sure that your listeners know how to find me, if that's okay.
Of course.
So my podcast, Baby or Bust Fertility Podcast, you can find me on YouTube for reproductive health information, a video every week. I have my own website. I love Instagram, TikTok. I just love educating. So please, Dr. Laura Shaheen on all of those platforms. And I really, really look forward to connecting with you.
Well, thank you for coming. And of course, everybody can also reach out to me at familybuilding.net and all the platforms as well. And thank you so much, Dr. Shaheen, for joining us and educating everybody out there. And thank you for all you do.
Thank you for making this happen, Lisa.
You're welcome. And all of you out there, I'll see you next time. Hi, it's Lisa Schumann, just popping in quickly to say thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you liked it, please rate, review, and subscribe, because that's how we keep going and come back for more.